Hello, and welcome to the American Marketing Association's Marketing Power Podcast, Collaborative Imagining, How to Make Creativity Work. I'm your host, Nancy Bacala, Senior Director of Online Content for the AMA. We're very excited to welcome our special guest, Joan Allaire, author of the new book, Imagine, How Creativity Works. Joan is a contributing editor at Wired and the author of How We Decide and Proust Was a Neuroscientist. He graduated from Columbia University and studied at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. He's written for The New Yorker, Nature, Seed, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. He's also a contributing editor at Scientific American Mind and National Public Radio's Radio Lab. You can connect with him on Twitter at Joan Allaire. Joan, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Joan, your book certainly talks about creativity from a very fascinating viewpoint, and it's a concept that's been inherently critical to the marketing function overall. How do you define creativity?
I define it very simply. I think creativity is coming up with a new idea that is useful. I don't think we need to get all fancy schmancy with definitions of creativity. I think creativity is one of those things we know it when we see it.
Great. You know, in your book, you seem to be shattering a couple myths, one of which is that only certain types of individuals have the creative gene. If that's really the case, what do you think drives certain people to be more creative than others?
That's a mystery. I mean, I think part of creativity, one of the big myths I wanted to explore in this book was this obsession with individual creativity. I think one of the reasons some people are much more creative than others is that they're in more creative environments. Creativity is much more social than we often give it credit for. So I think that's one explanation. I think creativity, like just about every human talent, is distributed. It's a bell curve, so some people are going to have a little bit more of it than others. That doesn't mean, though, that creativity is an all-or-nothing phenomenon. I think, you know, the big myth that we've gotten wrong about creativity is we assume there are creative types, and some people either have it and the rest of us don't. You know, you either are blessed with the creative genes or you're forced to just, you know, recycle the work of others. And I think that's not the case. I think creativity, the imagination, is embedded very deep in our software. It's an essential part of the way we think. We are connection machines. And so I wanted to understand, you know, this universal human talent and how the rest of us can get a little bit better at it.
Absolutely.
You know, even if we're not the most creative person in the world, we still have some creativity inside of us that we can unleash.
Exactly. So everyone has the opportunity to show their creativity.
Exactly. We can all get more creative. I think this is buttressed by, you know, study after study. One of my favorites showed that you can double performance on a classic test of creativity by simply putting people in a blue room. So
really?
Simply putting people in a blue room as opposed to a red room can double performance on a typical creative task. So this suggests that we're all much more creative than we typically give ourselves credit for. We just need to learn how to think. We need to learn how to unleash the imagination.
Great, great point. You know, as brands today are struggling to engage their customers, many organizations are being charged with not only finding good people, but good ideas. If good ideas emanate in part from creativity, does that mean that organizations today should actively be taking steps to foster creativity? And if so, what do you think some of those steps might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone needs to be in the creative game. When you look at, you know, from the most macro perspective possible, the end source of economic growth is new ideas. That is where all sustainable economic growth comes from. There is no shortcut around it. So I think we're all in the creative game. That's really where value comes from, whether it's coming up with a new brand, a new logo, a new marketing campaign, a new product, a new painting, a new book, et cetera, on down the line. You know, a big part of the book is actually focused on how companies and creative organizations can do a better job of it. It's everything from don't brainstorm. Whatever you do, don't engage in brainstorming. This is a classic creativity technique. It's probably the most widely implemented creativity technique of all time, and yet study after study shows that it just doesn't work, that brainstorming actually holds us back, and people are actually much better off when they violate the very first rule of brainstorming, which is thou shalt not criticize. That groups that engage in debate and dissent actually generate a lot more new ideas, and those ideas are rated as better by an independent panel of judges. So, you know, it's everything from don't brainstorm to make sure your employees are interacting with each other. I got to spend some time at Pixar, and, you know, when you appreciate the design of their studio, it's really all about forcing their different cultures, their computer scientists, their animators, forcing them to mix and mingle. So I think that's an important principle behind every office space, is forcing people who may not normally interact to interact, because it really is the human friction that makes the sparks, whether that friction comes from a conversation by the water cooler or from some criticism in a group meeting. That's what we need more of, more friction.
And the more voices, the better, I would assume, as well.
Yeah, yeah. More voices, especially a diversity of voices. And so this is real intellectual diversity. You want people from different backgrounds coming together to work on problems. That seems to be the best template for group creativity. You also want, I think, a diversity of social intimacy. So this is the work of Brian Usi primarily. He's a sociologist at Northwestern who does great research. And his template has been Broadway musicals. And he's found that the best Broadway musicals, and he's done this by data mining, a century worth of musicals, that the best musicals tend to consist of teams, a collaboration, where there are some good friends. Some people have worked together before many times, but then they often bring in a complete stranger, a total fresh voice. And his great case study is the team behind West Side Story, which consisted of several repeat collaborators, Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lorenz. But then they brought in this complete newbie, this complete novice, this 25-year-old lyricist who had never written for Broadway before, and his name was Stephen Sondheim. So when in doubt, be sure you've got a Stephen Sondheim on your team. Be sure you've got someone who you've never worked with before who can surprise you with all sorts of strange ideas.
Exactly. Good point. You know, one of the things I really loved about your book were all the great stories you had in there to support your concepts and your theories. And one of the stories you were evoking was about 3M specifically and how they organize for creativity. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, and one of the things that drew me to 3M is, I think it's easy to get really excited about the hot new company with a big new idea, this new startup, but 3M really has an unparalleled history of innovation. I mean, ever since they were a sandpaper company, and one of their engineers convinced them to come up with masking tape and came up with the idea behind putting tape on a roll, they've come out with product after product. They've got 50,000 employees and 55,000 products. So they really are this warehouse, this factory of innovation, and they've got a great legacy. And so I was interested in some of their cultural habits, their routines, their processes that I think have allowed them to come up with new idea after new idea. They've got a whole bunch of different tricks. They pioneered something called, the bootlegging day, where they allow their engineers to spend 15% of their day working on their own passion projects, their own hobbies. They don't need approval for this. All they have to do is promise to share the idea with their colleagues. This, of course, has since been widely implemented in places like Google. But when you look at, their history of innovation, a lot of their best ideas have come from these, the 15% of the day that their employees are free to do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big thing. They've got a biannual science fair where all their engineers from all their different fields come together and have posters and share ideas. One of, I think, their most interesting routines is they actually will typically force engineers to switch fields every 5 to 6 years. So if you've spent 5 years working on adhesives, and they've got obviously a big adhesive department, they may put you on drug delivery. They may move you to the medical side. They may have you work on LCD screens. And this is, from a certain perspective, this may seem really inefficient, right, because you're taking an expert and turning him into a novice. But they believe this is actually crucial, and they'll talk about how, moving a guy from adhesives into LCD screens, this is the true story, actually led to the invention. It's one of the most successful current products, which is a film that's applied to just about every screen in your home, I can guarantee it, which magnifies the brightness of bulbs. So it actually directs more of the illumination outwards, and this has helped them solve the battery life problem of a lot of gadgets. They'd spend years trying to come up with better batteries until they realized that really these batteries, a big drain in the batteries is the brightness of the screen. So you don't even need to tinker with the battery. If you simply make the bulbs brighter, if you direct more of the light outwards, then you can solve the battery problem without worrying about the chemistry of lithium. So that came from simply rotating engineers. So these are some of their tricks. The one thing I think a lot of these tricks have in common is they're all about increasing the amount of horizontal interaction.
Right.
That's a fancy term, but it basically just means getting people to talk to each other across domains. So they want knowledge to be freely shared, to be constantly transplanted from field to field. And I think that's a big part of why they've been so successful for so long.
That's great. I mean, gutsy move on their part, but it certainly got them some results, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with their track record.
Absolutely. You know, you ask any brand today pretty much, and they're all telling you that they're needing to draft a sort of a new definition of the big idea. They're all looking for that big idea to drive customer engagement experience today. What role do you think creativity has in generating that truly big idea that will help transform their brand?
I mean, I think, you know, that big idea is all about creativity. Typically, when you talk to scientists about big ideas, they'll talk about it in terms of moments of insight. That's actually the technical term for, you know, when we've got those big ideas in the shower, they come out of the blue. Scientists call those moments of insight. And there's been some really interesting research into how they happen. They seem so mysterious, you know. We're just shampooing our hair, and then, boom, we've got this revelation, this epiphany. And what most interests me about moments of insight, and there's been some great research on, a lot of it done by a guy named Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Cunios at Drexel, is that it turns out we're much more likely to have these big ideas when we're in relaxed states of mind. So when we're taking a shower, when we're playing ping pong, when we're going for a walk. And that struck me as counterintuitive because, you know, when I'm really stuck on a problem, when I feel like my back's up against the wall, I need a big idea, My first response is to say, well, I've got to work harder. I've got to drink more caffeine. I've got to chain myself to my desk. But that turns out to be the exact wrong approach. You know, I'll be focused, but I'll just be focused on the wrong idea. I'll be focused on the problem. And so, you know, learning about this research has actually helped me in my own, you know, everyday work. Now when I'm stuck, now when I feel like I need my big idea, I'm much more likely to take a long walk, to go take a shower, to follow the advice of Albert Einstein, who said creativity is the residue of time wasted. So now I'm much more willing to waste some time and you know, to trust that the answer will only arrive once I stop looking for it.
And to give yourself permission to do that.
Exactly. And that's where I think a lot of workplaces get it backwards. I think we're fixated on this very narrow definition of what productivity should look like. But when it comes to managing innovation, managing creativity, I think you have to realize that a lot of our most creative moments are going to happen when we're just taking a nap in the corner, when we're going for a walk, when we're doing things that to a stranger may look like the least productive, may look like we're just wasting time. But often that's necessary.
You know, in your book you reference a concept called the power of cue. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what that concept really addresses and how it might be applied to brands or organizations.
Sure. That speaks to the research I discussed just briefly earlier, Brian Uzzi's work on Broadway musicals. So when he was looking at the ideal template for group collaboration, he looked at all these Broadway musicals, thousands of different musicals, and constructed a social network of everyone on Broadway. And then for each musical, he assigned it a Q score, like the letter Q. And if you had a Q of 5, let's say, then you're all best friends. Everyone knows each other really, really well. If you have a Q of 1, you're all basically strangers. And when Uzi began working, he assumed that it'd be better to have a high Q, because then it'd be more freewheeling conversation, you know, people being more intimate, they'd be better sharing ideas. But that turned out to be completely wrong. Plays with high Qs tended to do really badly. They tended to bomb at the box office. Same was true of plays with a very low Q. So if your Q was around 1 or 2, the play also tended to fail. Instead, plays in the sweet spot of Q between 3.2 and 3.7. So think of West Side Story, where you had a couple good friends and also this complete stranger, this Stephen Sondheim figure. Those plays in the sweet spot were anywhere between 2 to 4 times more likely to succeed. So that's a big, big difference. So this led Uzi to conclude that getting the cue right, getting that right mix of social intimacy, is actually a really, really important part of collaboration. Mm-hmm. And we really don't think about it. You know, maybe if we're lucky, we think about intellectual diversity, about making sure we've got a mixture of people from different backgrounds. But in many instances, social diversity, social intimacy, having a mixture of friends and strangers may actually be even more important.
You know, speaking of social, in your opinion, do you think our current increasing usage of social media is inhibiting or fostering creativity?
I mean, it's tough to generalize. You know, I think there hasn't been a lot of good research yet on the subject. I think the phenomenon is just so new. I mean, I think one thing we can say for sure is that Facebook isn't yet a substitute for real world interactions that you know, that even in this age of Skype and FaceTime and email and video chats, there still is something intangible. There's some intangible benefit of that meeting in person, which is why we still schlep to video conferences and why we still live in big cities. And in many instances, these things have gotten more valuable. That even though we've got all these tools now, it's more important than ever to go to business conferences. An economist at Harvard told me this great factoid, which is that attendance at business conferences has doubled since the invention of Skype.
Really?
I haven't fact checked that, but it's almost too good to fact check.
Right.
But it does show that even though we could just do this all remotely, we still know there is something incredibly valuable about doing it in person, in the flesh. That human friction that comes from meeting in person. So, you know, social media may have all sorts of benefits, but I don't think we can see it as a replacement yet. We still need to meet in person. And I would also caution, and this is something that just speaks from my own experience, it's really important for me to sometimes leave my phone behind. You know, I mean, I sometimes wonder if the reason we've got all these anecdotes about, you know, having our breakthroughs in the shower, yes, it's relaxing, yes, it feels good to be pelted by warm water, but it's also the one place we can't take our phone. You know, it's the one place we can't check Twitter or Facebook or check our email. So maybe there's some benefit in that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're running out of time, but I do want to end with one question. Since you've just finished writing the definitive book on creativity, could you share with us what spurs your own creativity?
You know, I like taking long walks. I'm a walker. Mm-hmm. So before, you know, when I was stuck on a problem, I really would force myself to chug caffeine. I'd make a coffee and just say, Jonah, you're going to focus. You're going to crack this problem. And then, of course, you know, I'd squander hours, and then the next day I'd look at my work and realize it was all junk, and I'd be back to square one. Now I'm much more willing to take Albert Einstein's advice. And when I'm stuck, I go for a long walk. And to make those walks even more productive, I leave my phone behind. And that's my favorite recipe for creativity.
Well, that sounds like very good advice for a whole lot of people. Well, thank you. These have been great and fascinating insights about the concept of creativity and how companies and individuals alike can cultivate it. We've been talking to Jonah Lehrer. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to this edition of our AMA podcast series. I hope it's been a good learning and listening experience. You can look for more information on our podcast by visiting marketingpower.com. To learn more about Jonah's book, Imagine How Creativity Works, you can visit his website at jonahlehrer.com. That's JonahLehrer.com. Until next time, I've been your host, Nancy Bacala. Thanks for joining us.